Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Sunday, April 10th, 2011. I'm Sam Minter. I've got Yvonne Bo with me. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello. And Sam, as you can sound, doesn't sound too energetic.
I once again have a lovely head cold. You know, we'd been going for like, it seems like months, where there was some kind of cold, flu, something thing passing back and forth between members of the family here. Like, as soon as one person would be feeling a little bit better, the other person would start feeling bad, and that lasted, like, forever. And it seemed like we finally had kicked it for, like, the last few weeks. Everybody was basically not sick, okay? Now, we were still running ragged and having all kinds of things going on and tired and stuff like that, but we weren't sick. And then, like, earlier this week, you know, Alex starts daycare. Of course, he comes home after, like, the second day with his nose all dripping sick and stuff like that. Because, you know, this is what happens at daycares. They are, like, disease swap meets. Okay?
Yes.
And so, you know, so he comes home. And then, like, a couple days later, like, Thursday evening, actually. Like, you know, I was at work Thursday and I was fine. Thursday night, all of a sudden, I start feeling eh. And then Friday morning, I wake up and I'm like a big ball of snot, you know? And then I'm like, eh. And I, you know, I decide I'm not going into work, you know? I'll do some work from home. And I was going to have to leave early for a parent-teacher conference with Amy's teacher at the end of the day anyway. So I'm like, you know, I'm not going to go into work. I'm going to go, like, sneeze on Amy's teacher instead and get her sick. You know, and we actually ended up, like, sitting at some coffee shop, and I did my work there for most of the day. So I got everybody else sick, but I didn't get the people at work sick. So that was, and because of this whole thing, I actually, like, normally I get up early on Friday mornings and put out the podcast, and I completely and totally forgot. I remembered, like, late Friday night, oh shit, I haven't put out the podcast yet. And so I ended up putting it out, like, at it was done middle of the night, between Friday night and Saturday morning. And I put it out as soon as I woke up on Saturday morning, and oops, that's, like, the latest I've put it out in forever. And I know it's ridiculous. I know that, like, we record these things on a Sunday. Really, they should be out on Sunday or maybe Monday morning. By the time it gets to be Friday, even, like, we talk about current events, things happen, things get out of date. And I know, and I apologize, and I'm sorry. It's just the way my schedule works out these days. But Saturday is ridiculous. Like, you know, but anyway, at some point, maybe I'll get all that together, but probably not anytime soon. So, yeah, sorry.
Nah.
Anyway, we've got an exciting, exciting show. Woo! Planned for you. Number one is, of course, there's the whole drama leading up to a potential shutdown of the government, and then resolved at the last minute with it's not all said and done yet, but they beat the Friday deadline with an extension that goes to, like, Thursday of next week, and they think they have a deal that will go beyond that, and they're just hammering out the details. So we'll see. I mean, it could still break down, but it looks like the shutdown has been averted, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Then separately, and it's interesting because a lot of people are sort of mixing these two things up because they were sort of happening at the same time. Paul Ryan, a Republican, put out a proposal for a 2012 budget that tries to address sort of the debt and deficit issues in the longer term, by doing some fairly controversial things. And we'll talk about that. And then, you guys may have heard the Southwest Airlines had a plane that had a big hole open up in the top of it. And so they were checking a lot of planes, and we'll talk about that. And finally, Flash and, its usage, in the world. And then if we have any time, we have a few other backup topics, but, I think those will take us through a show.
Yep.
Anyway, so the shutdown, I first have to gloat, you know, several shows ago at the beginning of the year, Yvonne predicted shutdown. I predicted they would make a deal. Now, I made clear at that point that I was just making that prediction to counterbalance Yvonne. I really had no idea what I was talking about. But, nevertheless, my prediction came true. They came through with a deal at the last moment, and there was no shutdown. So, Yvonne, tell me your thoughts on this whole process and drama and back and forth that happened all week.
Well, I mean, let's face it. They were pretty narrowly apart. I think that there was a lot of posturing, and I think that there was a lot of people who basically just at one point just were trying to be, you know, trying to show their constituents.
Well, there were a lot of things like riders that weren't related to the budget, or not substantially related to the budget.
Right. I mean, because they started, you know, the government almost got shut down basically because some people, didn't have to do with a budget. It had to do with, about 40 riders that they were adding, stuff on abortion policy.
Things like funding Planned Parenthood and NPR and things like that.
Exactly. I think it was just preposterous that you get all these people talking about the budget, but yet, you know, they're really coming up the works with all of this shit. You know? I mean, really. It's always been that way, let's be honest. I mean, that's, you know, why people kept complaining about earmarks and all this other stuff and all this shit that kept getting added to bills that made them, you know, it's a transportation bill or a something bill, well, and all this.
And part of the final deal was that the agreement to let the Senate vote up or down on a 50-vote basis, not subject to filibuster, on some of these riders, essentially, but with the knowledge that they would all fail because there's a Democratic majority in the Senate. But you get that symbolic vote as opposed to holding up the whole functioning of the federal government in order to make a point on those items. I mean, they kind of did. They made their point. People heard them, but, you know, they weren't going to get their actual policy enacted as long as there was a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. So
now, they did push through a couple of things on there that, you know, if you look at them on the face, they didn't actually save any money right now. But I'm guessing that they were doing them in order to score some political points. They made a couple of changes in terms of things that would be funded by the healthcare law. You know, now, while minor, I think that they were trying to do it just simply to, you know, score some points that, oh, look, we knocked these provisions down. You know, one of them was a provision that I found quite interesting. The people were, were so all over. Business had opposed it significantly. Was a provision that would allow, low-income workers who didn't like their health insurance that they were offered through their employer, that they could get that the employer would be spending on the insurance, they could get that money and they could use it to buy health insurance from these healthcare cooperatives that were supposed to set up to provide health insurance. Now I'm trying to think, why in the world would the employers, honestly, me having provided before health insurance to employees, why in the world were they so opposed to it? I would think it's one headache off your head. But there were quite a lot of business groups that were opposed to it. And maybe I'm missing something that I'm not understanding about the cost of this or whatever, but bottom line, that was struck down. And then the other segment, I guess the insurance companies were probably pushing to kill this, was they actually cut the funding, at least for this year, to help set up the healthcare cooperatives. Now, it was a reduction, not a cut. You know, it didn't get eliminated. And it was only a temporary reduction that would just snap back at the end of this, you know, in October. Okay? It's only for the next few months.
Yeah, and let's clarify that important point on here, because this is a little confusing. All the stuff going on in the shutdown was not related to long-term budgets at all. It was related to the immediate authority to continue spending between now and October, right?
Correct. Yes. And the one thing about it is that those two things that they were pushing so hard on had nothing to do with really cutting the deficit right now. Nothing. They really, in essence, saved no money at this time. especially since you're negotiating a budget that starts next year. That, well, you know, it just, you can see how they were doing, I mean, all this stuff basically just to score political points.
They got a few billion of savings, right? It's just, it's a very minor amount compared to the overall problem.
Right. Correct. So, you know, I mean, it really was no significant change on the overall, you know, budget, you know, overall deficit or budget life, you know, across the multiple years. It just wasn't. So, you know, the first one, let's face it, the one about the insurance and like going to the cooperatives has no impact on the on the deficit whatsoever. None.
Right.
So
So just to let's move back. I think the practical results of the deal are simply government keeps functioning for the next few months. There are no significant changes going on there. You outlined a few minor changes. Yeah, so the end result of this is essentially status quo for the next few months, and then we have this battle again in October when it comes to the budget. But I think, yeah,
I mean, the battle is starting really now.
No, I know,
already.
I know. But I joked that, I was just taking the opposite position to take the opposite position, and I kind of was. But I did believe also that, look, the political forces aligned on this were that, you know, both nobody other than the Tea Partiers actually wanted a shutdown. Like, the leadership in both parties did not want a shutdown. They wanted to be practical.
Let's put it to you this way. Bonner had to, when he passed one of the previous extensions, there were 54 Republicans that voted against the earlier bill. He had to rely on the Democrats helping him get it through.
Right.
Because he didn't want a shutdown.
Right. And I think this is the thing. It's like, this is a issue where the only people who wanted to sort of make the shutdown happen were the extremity of the Republican Party. The mainstream of both parties, even with both parties having become sort of squeezing out the middle, wanted to get a deal done, wanted to have the government continue. And it was just a question of how to do it in such a way that everybody can go home claiming to win, essentially. And so, you know, what that ended up being is Bonnier and company, you know, going up to the last minute, keeping, you know, we got to have this, making a lot of points about these riders and stuff, and then at the last minute, you know, making some face-saving deal to get the thing done. And it looks like there wasn't a Tea Party rebellion on this either, where they all voted against the deal, which would have been interesting. But I think this is almost what had to happen. Like, everybody recognized that an actual shutdown, well, let's put it this way. The Republican leadership recognized that an actual shutdown would probably, in the end, be bad politically for them. So they did not want to push through to that outcome. They were only going in that direction because they felt they were forced to by the Tea Party wing of the party. You know, if you didn't have the Tea Partiers jumping up and down, they probably wouldn't have gotten anywhere near as close to the end here. They would have struck a deal, you know, a while back. And so, you know, they made the points they needed to make, and then they made a deal. And I think, you know, that's likely what's going to end up happening again when we talk about the full budget later. But we'll see. There'll be some even the pressures in politics around that will be different. Enough about the shutdown. It didn't happen. If the shutdown had happened, we'd undoubtedly be spending a lot more time talking about the effects it was having on people, blah, 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 how long it would last.
I will say this. You know, I think the entire drama surrounding it, I think the fact that somebody mentioned that probably Bonner and Obama spent more time negotiating over stuff, you know, this last week that they probably spent, you know, they've spent the whole in Obama's entire administration. Look, if we're going to do something really to try to really improve our fiscal house, this is the kind of sit downs that the people need to have, and they need to, you know, arrive at a compromise.
Well,
they did.
And I think Bonnier's actually signaled in a number of areas that he's willing to work. You know, he's willing to actually work with the Democrats and try to come out with compromises. He's not wanting to follow the, you know, say no to everything plan to just stop anything from happening. He's willing to actually, you know, have these compromises and work through things. The question is whether his caucus will. I mean, you know, and whether he can lead in that direction, and whether, you know, the House Republicans will actually follow him, or whether they'll rebel if he starts working. But I think he himself has signaled on a few occasions that he wants to get things done. He doesn't want to sit there and just be an obstructionist. Anyway, let's take a break. We'll be back and talk about the Paul Ryan budget proposals in just a few minutes. So enjoy your break. We'll be right back.
This is a break. Oh, yes, this is a break. This is a break because no one gave me any suggestions. I told you. I warned you, so this is a break. This is a wonderful break, a wonderful break. Yes, indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudgeon's Corner. Yes, this is a break. Yes, yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, 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 this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, it is a break. And now the break is over.
And here we are. So now we're no longer talking about continuing resolutions to last over the next few months. We're talking about budget plans for the long-term future. Now, at least one commentator has pointed out that in the long run, the budgets themselves are actually more political documents. It actually is the appropriation bills that actually run the government that try to implement the budgets. And so how much the budgets themselves end up mattering is depends on, you know, because again, what actually happens is determined later when the appropriation bills to enact the budget actually happen. Having said that, the budget documents are officially what allows, you know, what defines what the government spending is supposed to be over the coming year. For the last few years, they've consistently been late or non-existent. I mean, like, the reason we had all this continuing resolution nonsense that was leading up to the shutdown was the Democrats failed to pass a budget of any sort the previous year.
Because they sucked ass. Because, honestly, I am still – could I say how – I mean, incompetent, I must say, Nancy Pelosi was, that she couldn't fucking pass a goddamn budget. I mean, really? You had a fucking Senate majority and a House majority and a Democratic president, and you can't fucking pass a budget? I mean, sorry. You know, unacceptable, in my opinion.
Anyway, so one of the things that's been coming up repeatedly is, of course, you know, we're still sort of in a recovery of the job situation and stuff, but the federal government has a major problem in terms of running long-term budget deficits. The federal debt is just increasing exponentially. No one even generally even talks about paying down the debt. They're only talking about trying to get the deficit to down some. And people recognize that.
Now listen, we are at a point still where our debt,
as a percentage of GDP,
is lower than a lot of other industrialized nations.
Yeah.
I mean, including than most, including Japan. I mean, Japan has a much worse debt problem than we do, which is one of the concerns that they have right now with the earthquake and trying to borrow money for rebuilding when the government is just in hock. In such a way that we're not even remotely close.
Having now, said that, the percentage of our budget each year that goes towards interest of the debt, if you were talking about, like, you know, a personal household, that would be an insane percentage that you would say that person is out of control. But you know, governments are different. But
Print money, and we can't. I mean, if I could print money, I would run a massive deficit too. I mean, I'm like, oh well, honey, fire up the presses.
Yes,
you know,
there you go.
I mean, it would be great.
But in any case, people seem to universally agree that long term running deficits forever is at some point in the future going to cause problems. Arguments ensue on how far in the future, how long we can do whatever, blah, 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 whether we can grow out of it by just increasing the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But in any case, it over the last few years, with the combination of the Bush tax cuts plus the various wars plus all this kind of stuff, we've got a much worse situation than we did, say, in the Clinton years, where we actually had a surplus for a few years.
Yeah. Plus, the one thing is that we've got right now is, you know, we have this demographic time bomb, which we knew about, which is one of the reasons why in the 90s there was so much focus on trying to rein in the deficit, because we knew we had this demographic time bomb that was going to come like 10, 15, you know, in the next 10, 15, 20 years.
We're basically talking about the baby boomers going through retirement and old age. Because we have, you know, Medicare... specifically Medicare, not Medicaid, it's got its own issues, which is essentially guaranteed health coverage to everybody, 65 and above?
Yeah, 65, yeah, because, yeah, Social Security can claim at 62, but not Medicare.
Yeah, so, 65. And, you know, we've got a huge bulge of people from the baby boom generation going through that age range, while overall the society has had declining birth rates, et cetera. So the ratio and all of these programs, just to be clear, although they sometimes make you think it's sort of like you pay into it and then you get your benefits, are very much pay as you go.
They weren't supposed to be, but they are.
The current working people pay for the current retired people. It's not really so much the retired people, you know, in their time, put in their money and they're getting it back. In general, they will get back considerably more than they put in.
Now, granted, we don't have the same problem as Europe or Japan, where we've had very low, where they've had extremely low birth rates. And those extremely low birth rates have led to major problems, you know, right now with their budget. We have much higher fertility.
But our birth rates have lowered, but not as much. But also, we've also made up for it by immigration in a way that some of these other places have not. So
that's correct.
So anyway, There was a commission a few months back that Obama had, a bipartisan commission that came out with a bunch of recommendations, and which basically got ignored and shelved once it came back. That may have been the first sort of serious proposal to try to deal with this, although it was ignored. A lot of people are saying this is the second one, where Paul Ryan came out with a budget with a lot of things people really, really are on the left are, you know, like, this is a non-starter. How can you even think about this? Like essentially phasing out Medicare as we know it in preference to sort of a private voucher sort of program, things like that. However, you know, it actually attempts to, you know, whether or not it's successful or not, and there are a lot of assumptions it makes that people criticize, but it actually is an attempt to actually put together what kind of budget would look like that would try to address these issues.
I think the main thing that he did is that he didn't go like everybody else has been doing, especially a lot of the people that came in with the Tea Party revolution. All of these people were kept talking about earmarks and all of this shit and blah, blah, blah,
stuff
and how they're
going to
cut spending and they're going to do. And that is all hogwash. I mean, you could cut those 100%, get rid of them all, and we are fucked anyway financially, okay? It doesn't solve dick, okay? The only way to address the budget deficit is to address these big issues in Social Security and Medicare, okay? And then number three, our military spending, okay?
Yep.
Those are the top three. If you don't touch those, you don't get anywhere, okay? Period.
And fundamentally, touching those, in the end, I mean, there's almost no way around it. You can talk about finding efficiencies and all that kind of stuff, but there's almost no way around the fact that touching those and addressing those does mean reducing benefits.
Correct.
And then you can decide which benefits you're going to reduce and how, but you are not going to be able to solve this problem on the cutting side without reducing benefits. Now, the flip side of this is, of course, taxes. And Ryan doesn't have tax increases in his budget. I mean, people have pointed out as well that if you simply let the Bush tax cuts actually expire and expire in full on everybody, middle class, rich, poor, everybody, if you let those expire, you know, you a significant that makes a significant chunk here, because yes. And really, like, I'd almost view one view of seriousness in these proposals is you have to do both. You know, you have to have major cuts in these entitlement programs, which, yes, means less benefits to people who really need them. And there's no way around it. Yes, these people need them. Yes, these people will be worse off without it. But yes, they will have to be cut because we can't freaking afford it. And on the flip side, tax increases. Now, I don't want freaking tax increases. I don't like paying taxes.
I don't like
taxes.
Tax increases.
But
I just had to pay fucking $10,000 in taxes, for God's sakes.
I still have to do mine.
I got
to
write a check. I got to write a check for the other two, which I am holding off on sending until the 18th at night on the last minute, okay? All right? Because yeah, I'm certainly not getting paid.
I haven't even
early.
Done my taxes okay? yet. I have to do that sometime before the 18th. Now, this was one thing, of course. I forgot to make the joke because, of course, it's not true. But, like, if only the government had shut down, does that mean I don't have to pay my taxes? But, unfortunately, the IRS is one of those critical services. You still have to pay your fucking taxes. But, anyway. Now, they didn't shut it down anyway.
A little bit understaffed in terms of processing your return, but still.
Anyway. Yes.
Well, actually, they did say that they would not have people to process tax refunds.
Yes. Right. You wouldn't get your refund, but you were still on the hook for actually paying your freaking taxes if you owed anything.
Yeah, you were still on the hook
and submitting
your
form.
Right. Correct. So, right. But they wouldn't have anybody. Everything had to be postmarked on time, even if the government was shut down. Correct.
Yes. Anyway. So Paul Ryan's plan, I mean, like, the reactions have been very mixed to this. Like, you know, there have been quite a few, like, even people who opposed a plan who are like, at least this is a serious proposal. But then you get other people who are like, this isn't a serious proposal. I mean, it starts out essentially with let's get rid of Medicare. And that's a non-starter.
I think that assuming that is just ridiculous. I mean, that is a non- why is that a non-starter? I mean, it's an option. I mean, it's not unrealistic. Maybe
he does try to propose something else to take its place. Now, a lot on the left argue that the thing that he's proposing to take its place is woefully inadequate, and the whole thing is a dismantling of. It really does translate into a dismantling of the program, and you know maybe that's true, but I think it is like part of the debate. Now, one of the things I want to see going on here. Is and to measure again the seriousness of any conversation on this issue is do Obama or the Democrats come up with a serious counterproposal or do they just say they want to get rid of Medicare?
I was just looking at a post on Huffington Post apparently that Obama apparently is going to prepare a response to Paul Ryan's proposal.
That would
okay?
be excellent. If we actually have that conversation where we have the two sides say, you know, look, we will both come up with proposals that match on, you know, the amount of deficit reduction that happens. Like, so Democrats come out with something that cuts at least as much as the Republican plan, but does it in a different way that reflects Democratic priorities rather than Republican priorities, then boom, you have two things that you can start negotiating on, where you both are agreeing that you have to make such and such a difference to the budget, and you're now just arguing over how. And, you know, arguing over how, by the way, is hard and problematic, and coming to a deal there is by no means trivial, but at least you're both on the same page in terms of what you want to be doing, in terms of the end bottom line result. So we'll see what happens. I mean, when the Deficit Reduction Commission report came out, I mentioned it was basically a dead letter. One of the things that was said at this point, and I forget if it was on the record or leaked out or whatever, was basically that the Obama administration's position was this probably is the kind of thing that we need to be doing, but we're not going to go first. You know, somebody else has to put out a proposal first.
Well, I'm going to give props to Mr. Ryan for having the balls to go out there and take a whole bunch of stuff there and go first.
Yeah,
and stop with this bullshit.
I mean, basically, the Obama administration was saying we need political cover from the Republicans to even engage in this conversation. Because if you can imagine if the Obama administration came out and as their first move put out a plan that has all kinds of entitlement cuts, they would be destroyed by the left of their own party. However, if they end up as sort of pre-capitulating to Republican demands and things like this, which is one of the things that Obama has gotten criticized for over and over again. But on the other hand, if the Republicans come out something and then they respond and then it goes back and forth, you know, in the end, the bottom line is, like you said, in order to actually address this problem seriously, you have to make cuts. And if you actually make cuts, there are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. There are people that are going to hate it and be jumping up and down about it. I mean, all you have to look to is the various countries that are in Europe who have done austerity programs over the last year or so for their budgets.
Oh, my God. I mean, look. Portugal tried to put through an austerity. The prime minister finally had to resign because he tried to, on three occasions, to pass a budget to cut the deficit, and it did not pass. And he had to resign. And right now, Portugal is begging the European Union for a bailout, basically because their government is just unwilling or incapable of passing any cuts on spending whatsoever.
Yeah,
and bottom line,
you've had demonstrations and riots in Greece, Italy, the UK,
Ireland,
and basically it's all over this kind of issue, which is that in the end, you know, the governments just no longer have the amount of money to spend on all of these benefits that people have become accustomed to. Now, one could argue on the flip side that these benefits could be sustained by doubling everybody's taxes. Or whatever is necessary along those lines. And they probably could be, but you can be damn sure people would be pissed at that too. So it's kind of a no-win situation here. You know?
That's pretty much it.
You either have to raise taxes, cut benefits, or more likely both in order to even try to address the situation. And no matter what you do, there are going to be people who are very unhappy. No matter what you do, there are people whose lives are going to be dramatically affected for the worse because of these changes. But the bottom line is that it's just the money's not there to do it right now. Now, maybe that'll change. Maybe economies will rebound and everybody will be, running around in bathtubs full of money in a few years. Who knows? But right now, you can't get there from here. And even Paul Ryan's plan, I mean, people have pointed out that it makes assumptions of the unemployment level dropping really fast down to levels that have never been seen in the history of the country. You know, that's not going to happen. But at least, but no matter what you do, you're going to have to do painful things because all the Western democracies have been living off resources that aren't actually there for a while, and people have gotten used to it. And so at some point, you have to pay the price for that.
Yep. Yeah, you do. And the price has got to be, you got to do something let's face it, Argentina had to default on their debt. They couldn't pay it. These people are all asking for bailouts, but really, a Portugal default. I mean, if the other European Union countries just say, screw it, we're not doing this. It may be the thing to do, So.
Yeah, I mean the default, certainly, I guess, in the end ends up being an option. But then that has all kinds of ramifications to all kinds of people as well.
Hey, let's face it. More people – let me put it to you this way. If you add the dollars of people who've defaulted on mortgages in the U.S., it's probably far more than, say, what a Portugal debt default would be, for example.
Right. So, well, yeah. But, taking the example forward, in the U.S., if in the end they can't, like, figure out how to deal with this stuff over the next 30, 40 years, you know, come 2050, we may be talking about what happens if the U.S. defaults.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I'll tell you this. If the Japanese haven't yet defaulted, I'm like, you know, and they're at 200%+ of debt. Well, I'm like, you know.
Yeah, part of that, too, is also the possibility of, you know, I guess, what if people called it a soft default or whatever, where you just use inflation to get out of it?
Well, yeah, you could do that. I mean, you just basically just run the printing presses, baby.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
And then
could that, do that.
You know, your nominal deficit remains, your nominal debt remains the same, but it becomes a much smaller percentage of the economy because you've made everything else cost more. And of course, that's painful in its own way. So anyway, let's take a break. It's time for the poem of the week, and we'll be back to talk about, you know, old airplanes falling out of the sky and Flash. We'll see you after the poem. Enjoy.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by No-Tel Motel.
Intersection by Laura Van Proyen. Because I cannot call you, you do not exist. Because we once ate at Emilio's, I can't drive by without looking. Today is hot. I remember you fighting a woman for the last fan on the shelf that July. You may very well be listening to crickets now. You may be rocking a child. I drive my children past the forest where we did not go. My skirt is not so short anymore. I stop at the red light where you did not kiss me, where we did not stop.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
And we're back. Exciting poem is over. So what's with old planes, Yvonne? That we had a Southwest flight have to make an emergency landing because there was a big hole in the side.
Well, the one thing about it, it was aluminum fatigue in a section of the plane, and in a plane of an age that they didn't expect to have that kind of.
Didn't we learn all about this with the, like, we had that convertible Hawaii flight, like, 30 years ago?
Well, yeah, but we did. And so they had stepped up the inspections, and that was an older 737, and they, you know, they had come up with these parameters for the inspections, and they actually modified how they build new 737s based a little bit on that as well.
For our younger listeners who don't remember, I don't know when this flight was. Was it in the
80s? In the late 80s.
You know, there was a Hawaiian Air flight. And basically the entire, well, not the entire, but a big, huge chunk of the roof of the plane just came off.
Yep, it just peeled off. It looked like somebody took a can opener and just peeled off the roof.
Right, and so this thing essentially ended up landing. Like, people talked about it as, like, a miracle that the pilot could even get the thing to fly and it didn't completely crash. He managed to land the plane. I believe there were a lot of minor injuries, and I believe the only loss of life was, like, a flight attendant who got sucked out when the roof came off. But anybody who was in their seatbelts and such landed fine, you know, whatever. So there was a lot of looking around at metal fatigue type issues at that point because, you know, hey, you just had a plane lose its roof in flight. So anyway, they made some changes at that point.
Airlines with a dire financial situation they've been over the last few years, I mean, they're really flying quite older planes, okay? Now, you know, let's face it, airline safety has actually improved significantly over the last 20 years. I mean, the number of fatal accidents has really gone down. I mean, I think one of the last major ones that we really had of a major airline was that Air France plane that we had crash for between Brazil and Paris, and that this week they actually found finally underwater. They finally found the plane. Okay, I don't know if you saw that in the news, but they actually finally did find it took them 2 years of searching into the bottom of the ocean. So they actually found the bodies and everything. So they're hoping to figure out what the hell actually finally happened to the plane.
Yeah, because that's one where there was because they lost the whole plane over the mid-ocean, the amount of evidence they had to try to figure out what was happening was much more limited than usual. And they have they had a number of ideas related to how the the airspeed indicators and flying through a storm and stuff like that, but they didn't have all the usual physical evidence that they try to use in those investigations. Anyway, sorry, move on.
Yeah, anyway, so the one thing about it is just that I guess that, you know, with the airline industry and the way it is, I mean, they are flying a lot older planes, and I guess even with inspections and everything that you can do, you know, you're still going to have things like this pop up, but I guess the one thing is just to put into perspective. I mean, let's face it. The plane did not crash. The people landed safely. It was a hole. Yes, it's a scary event. I'm sure you're on it. All of a sudden, going, like, to a rapid decompression. Nobody enjoys that. They went and took a nosedive, and, you know, they went, the pilot went, just fucking hit the nose down and fucking just brought the plane down from 25,000 feet, like, you know, super fast. But in the end, I mean, you know, still, I mean, I think that you look at the safety record that we've had, and with those incidents, I guess I wouldn't be so worried about it. You know, it's not like compared to some other places. I was looking at what airline has the oldest fleet? Okay, all right, you would think. I'm like, I found out that it's the Venezuelan airline, Aeropostal, has the oldest airline fleet in the world, okay? It's an average age of 28 years, okay? Now, if I were flying a 28-year-old Venezuelan plane, I would be freaked out, okay? All right? I would not feel comfortable. However, I will say that I would take all the major U.S. carriers. If I were flying a 28-year-old plane, which actually some of them do have, I believe Delta still has a whole bunch of 30-plus-year-old MD-80s that came from Northwest. I mean, does it suck like a plane? As a plane? Yes, I flew on one of them. They came from Northwest. I remember it was the noisiest piece of shit plane I've ever been in my life. When I landed after 1 hour flight, my head hurt, okay? All right? From how loud it was. But it wasn't done safe. It was a safe plane. Okay, so, you know, unless you're flying some weird foreign airline that you never heard of, that, you know, the maintenance is, like, you know, suspect, I would say that even any of the old aircraft that we fly in the U.S., I would feel comfortable still flying. I mean, think about this. I just realized today, the you know, B-52s. Okay, not a passenger plane, but still, you know, an aircraft is flying around. I mean, the B-52s were built, all of them, until 1960. They've been flying for 50 years. And, you know, the Air Force right now is planning on having those planes fly for another 20 to 30 years. Okay? And they're still, you know, going and running missions all around the world. So, you know, you can run these fuckers really, as long as you maintain them well, practically forever. So.
Right. Well, and that's, of course, the key is, you know, do people feel that they really have been being maintained to the standards that they should? Are people, you know, are any airlines, you know, trying to do cost savings by reducing some of their inspections or, you know, cutting back on some of the routine maintenance, et cetera, et cetera? And that's the kind of thing I think people are worried about, is that as these airline companies are under financial pressure, they'll skimp on some of these areas, and eventually it'll lead to something bad happening. I mean, like you said, they already have older fleets because of that. Like, if they were doing much more healthy business financially, they might have replaced a lot of these planes already.
But they probably would have, yes. But the one thing is that if you look at the statistics and you look at the number of incidents, you look at a number of things happening over the years, I mean, I still feel, you know, we are, it, even though the fleets have gotten older, the number of accidents has gone down.
Yeah, this is a very important thing to note, you know, that, you know, this is another place where, you know, human beings' ability to assess risk rationally is very bad. You have to actually look at the numbers and not just be reactive to, you know, emotion. And this applies, you know, we were talking the other week about, you know, nuclear power and the potential results there, but it applies just as well here. I mean, any sort of rational look at statistics shows that, you know, airline safety has been consistently increasing over the decades. You know, if you know, whatever scare you have now, it's still like a dozen times safer than having taken a flight in the 1970s. You know?
Yep, absolutely.
On the best airlines in the world. I mean, because overall, it's just been ramping up and ramping up. Same thing is true of car safety. And, you know, people, same kind of arguments are true about, like, violent crimes and such. People, like, will get upset about the latest school shooting or whatever that happened. But overall, you know, deaths from, you know, violent shooting activities have been on a dramatic decline over the decades.
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, you have to look at the actual numbers and not react sort of viscerally when things happen. Anyway, let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk briefly about Flash, and then we'll wrap up the show. Okay, we'll be right back after this exciting whatever it'll be.
Tag yourself with Blue Protection.
For the most accurate health information, visit www.cdc.gov or call 1-800-CDC-INFO 24/7.
As Yvonne sings us back in, we're back. So, Yvonne, you saw something about one of the things we've talked about here a few times is the whole thing with, you know, iPads and iPhones and all those kinds of things not having any support whatsoever to Flash. And this being a pain in the ass on certain applications, certain websites, and other vendors try to make a big deal out of, oh, we do support Flash. You just saw an article saying that
Flash usage is going down. That's one thing that's going on right now. According to some statistics, see if I can pull them up again.
And sources.
Flash use dip. At news.com, okay, there's an article there in Top Technology News right now that indicates Flash use dips at top websites since November. Webpage speed guru Steve Souders, putting to use the latest in a string of useful tools he's created, has found that the top 17,000 websites have eased off use of Adobe Systems Flash Player in the last half year. Specifically, Souders has started showing data collected by his HTTP archive project, which logs a wide range of statistics about a collection of 17,000 top websites. Okay, and it shows that usage has dropped on top websites from 49% to 47% since November. Okay, now maybe it's not a huge dip. Okay, but given that it used to be increasing substantially, the fact that all of a sudden now it is decreasing. I think that's a big statement. I've seen a lot of people that are just, you know, the main thing that I've seen a lot of people arguing, especially now that Microsoft's also launched IE9 supporting HTML5. I think Google's also supporting HTML5 with Chrome. Everybody is just that, you know, nobody needs this resource hog, period. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a waste. I mean, it's just, you know, it's clunky, it's heavy, it's slow. Geez, the other day, you know, I just realized how fucking clunky and pain in the ass damn thing is. I was logging onto a website for I can't remember what, and they have this fucking Flash animation intro that loads up that I'm like, my God, I mean, really? Do I really need this?
Yeah, almost always are those kinds of things. There's just something that gets in the way of you actually finding whatever you went there to look for, you know?
Yes!
You know, yes, and there are things like Flash games and such, But for that, and so, some of them, those are entertaining, of course. But you know, you've got alternatives for all this stuff. I don't know, and like the worst offenders are the things like what you just described, either the intro splash pages or you know, like you know, one example that pisses me off is like when I'm going to like a restaurant website to try to like preview their menu or something. And they've got like some fancy flash animated version of their menu, like that. A, I can't see it on my phone. But B, you know, even if I can see it on my computer, it just like gets in the way of me getting to that information quickly. I just want to get there, you know, and get in and see what I want to see. And you just make me go through all this stuff instead. And then like, once I get there, I can't copy and paste what I see if I wanted to, because it's all like a picture anyway, it's annoying. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't legitimate uses of Flash, but I'd say 95% of the use of Flash on the internet is stuff that's just, I'd rather not have. And of course, this is why I've mentioned on the show before, I use, a thing called Click to Flash. It's available for various different browsers, but basically it makes it so that any place where there's Flash just shows up as a little gray box on your browser, and if you want it, you can click it and it'll load the Flash, but otherwise it won't bother. And yeah, so I no longer see most of these annoying things, and at this point I only get annoyed when I'm trying to find a piece of information that I really want and I have to click that there. Button. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a website for a jeweler, okay, that has some information that I like looking at a couple of times, and for whatever the hell fucking reason, they offer no HTML version of the stupid thing. It's just a Flash site, and my God, is it a fucking annoying site. I mean, it is slow to, it doesn't matter, PC, Mac, anything. It is slow to load. It is slow to pick. It is slow to everything. And I'm just like, every time you go to another page, you see this swirling time. Wait. Now, it may look all the graphics are nice and whatever, but my God, seriously, is it such a bad site to use? I mean, it's just ridiculous. I'm just that is. I must admit that probably is one of the websites with the most overkill that I've seen of Flash use ever. Well, and it sucks.
And going back to the bigger issue, I mean, you and I have talked about this before as to whether it's a real liability for iPads and such. And certainly, it's a pain point right now. But I think this is the inevitable trend. I mean, because as you know. First of all, as more devices come out there that can't even see the stuff, companies who do websites right. have to come up with alternatives because they know, like, they're excluding iPad users or whatnot, who are a larger and larger percentage that's out there. And, you know, other devices that do Flash but not well also produce a bad experience. So, like, people have talked about, like, some of these tablets that have come out based on Android supposedly have Flash support, but apparently it sucks. You know, you know, in the ones that have had it where it's really slow and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that's not much better either. So, and people will just be annoyed by it. So I think, you know, in the end, you know, something that serves no purpose other than annoying people is inevitably, you know, going to reduce its usage. I don't know. I think Flash will be dead in a few years. People will have moved on to other things. You know. I don't know.
I think that you're right. I mean, I think that you know, because of the how heavy it is, how much resources it hogs, and how many issues it's got, I see other technology replacing it. I just don't see how this thing can just continue to just exist as is.
Right. I mean, and, you know, Adobe may well figure out something else to do instead, but Flash as we know it today.
They do a whole bunch of other things. I know they do. You know.
I mean, they've got this little thing called Photoshop. I don't know. Nobody's ever heard of that, but.
Yeah, no. And Acrobat and
all kinds of stuff. Anyway, yep. Flash use dipping, I say good riddance. But anyway.
I agree.
I think that's a show.
All right.
Okay.
I think that's a show. That's a wrap.
And I'll just give you an update on, like, my wonderful cold here. Over the course of this show, my eyes have gotten all puffy and irritated, and like at this point I can barely open them. So I'm sitting here talking into the microphone, occasionally squinting at the screen to see how much time we've got. But basically I'm like, I want my eyes to be closed now. So we'll wrap it up on that exciting and gooey note. Thanks, everybody, for listening. As usual, email me, abelsmay@abelsmay.com, for any questions, thoughts, suggestions, new breaks for the show. Send us audio. We enjoy all that. Tell your friends to listen, too. We like listeners. And that's it. See you next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Later, Yvonne.